The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Brandy Spragata for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Magazine. Khomeini. He remembers thinking, I'm a dead man. But the expected didn't happen, or not against him. His Japanese translator was killed, his Norwegian publisher was shot, and his Italian translator knifed. Then, recently, in upstate New York, just before a discussion about the United States serving as a refuge for writers, Rushdie was assaulted on stage by a 24-year-old stranger wielding a knife. The savage attack, which inflicted grievous wounds but mercifully didn't prove fatal, had come 33 years after the fatwa. In February 1989, the Ayatollah's Act had introduced a new word, as Nobel laureate Nadine Gordimer noted, in the Oxford Dictionary of New Words, fatwa. Originally a generic term for any legal decision made by a religious authority, but because of the particular context in which the West became familiar with the word, it is sometimes erroneously thought to mean death sentence. After that first call from the BBC reporter, Rushdie thought he had only a few days to live, a single-digit number. He left his home that day and didn't return till years later, when it wasn't even any longer his. He was required to have a code name so his cover wouldn't be blown. He chose Joseph Anton. For all of those years, a fictional name, a combination of the names of two writers he admired, Joseph Conrad and Anton Chekhov. Policemen from the special branch guarded him around the clock. He spent 9 years in hiding. What were his days like? The novelist Peter Carey, in a letter written to mark 1,000 days of Rushdie's exile, tried to imagine this life. The fear, the loneliness of confronting your own face in God knows how many different mirrors and how many different safe houses, cleaning your teeth with a toothbrush a policeman has purchased for you, sleeping in strange beds with musty sheets, in old houses that make strange noises at night, new apartments with loud clocks, rattling refrigerators, heating that is too high or too low, and the distant voices of neighbors you will not meet. This is what writers do, imagine other lives. Give voice to our experience and the experience of others on God's not-so-green-any-longer earth. When I was 24, the same age as his assailant, Rushdie was magically imagining my life and making it real. Or so it felt. I was a new immigrant in the United States, and in essay after essay, later collected in Imaginary Homelands, Rushdie offered me a language to recognize myself as an individual in the West. He had always asked, how does newness enter the world? It was a migrant's question. Rushdie also piteously excoriated the examples of Raj nostalgia being marketed in films and TV. I would hungrily watch those shows, but there was the writer teaching me how to view them in a political way. Against oversimplification and stereotyping, he emphasized complexity in history. Now, of course, the Far Pavilions is the purest build, Rushdie wrote. The great processing machines of TV soap opera have taken the somewhat more fibrous garbage of the MMK book and pureed it into easy swallow, no chewing, necessary drivel. Thus, the two central characters, both supposedly raised as Indians, have been lobotomized to the point of being incapable of pronouncing their own names. In reading such lines dismissing a false orient of cruel-lipped princes and the dusky, slim-hipped maidens, I was attracted by the political stance, of course, but I was also stirred by the language itself. For me, a young man from a provincial town in India, to read Rushdie was to lose one's timidity when using English, the language of our former rulers. We can now declare our independence in the use of the language itself, flaunt it like he did, and suddenly appear bold and flamboyant. Years passed. I also became a writer. It was the realization of a dream I had carried inside me so long. At literary festivals, I would cross paths with Rushdie. We had our political differences, too, because we were changing, and so was the world around us. In 2012, en route to the Jaipur Literature Festival, I was excited to learn that I would see Rushdie there. But there was trouble. On my first day at the festival, the newspapers reported that hired assassins from the Mumbai underworld were on their way to assassinate Rushdie, and that this visit had been called off. The intelligence reports were later revealed to be fiction, cops as magical realists. When the time came for my fellow writer Hari Kunzru and I to read from our work, we decided to protest Rushdie's absence by reading instead from the Satanic Verses, a book banned in India since its publication in 1988. The book was banned, yes, but we could download it on the internet. Our reading caused an immediate furor. The police arrived and we were asked to leave the country. But what I want to say here is that I felt a great sense of freedom, a liberation from fear, as I read Rushdie's words out in public in the country of his birth. All the inventiveness and joy of his fiction was there in the section of the Satanic Verses that I read out at the festival, when Gabriel Farishta considers the advantages of magically transforming London into a tropical city. Religious fervor, political ferment, renewal of interest in the intelligentsia. No more British reserve. Hot water bottles to be banished forever, replaced in the fetid nights by the making of slow and odorous love. Emergence of new social values, friends to commence dropping in on one another without making appointments, closure of old folks' homes, emphasis on the extended family, spicier food, the use of water as well as paper in English toilets, the joy of running fully dressed through the first rains of the monsoon. It had been important to do this, to remind readers of the pleasures of the book, even as outside there were calls for book burnings in the author's head. Albert Camus believed that a writer's work is nothing but a slow trek to rediscover through the detours of art those two or three great and simple images in whose presence his or her heart first opened. The importance that Rushdie holds in our hearts, I mean here writers close to his age like Hanif Qureshi, or from succeeding generations like Kiran Desai, Raj Kamal Jha, Sukhetu Mehta, Ayat Akhtar, Taya Obret, and Zadie Smith, is that there is a fundamental gesture or stance in our own writing that can be traced to what he accomplished in a book like Midnight's Children. What is true of writers is also, of course, true of readers. We all carry the memory of our encounters with books and their impress on our minds and our lives. In my case, I have never forgotten Rushdie's declaration back in the early 1980s that the modern world lacks not only hiding places, but certainties. He was saying there is no safe haven of religious belief or political quietism. Everything was open to question and revision. In his essay Outside the Whale, he declared, "We are all irradiated by history. We are radioactive with history and politics. We see that it can be as false to create a politics-free fictional universe as to create one in which nobody needs to work or eat or hate or love or sleep." I have found this credo inspiring when writing my fiction. Has Hadi Matar, the young man who so cruelly stabbed Rushdie multiple times, ever read the man he attacked? Would he know that soon after the fatwa in a short poem that Rushdie published in Granta, he wrote of wanting to sing on in spite of attacks, to sing while my dreams are being murdered by facts, praises of butterflies broken on racks? That image of butterflies broken on instruments of torture is so striking and so powerful that I see at once why the great literary critic Edward Said once commented that Rushdie represented the intifada of the imagination. 10 years after the fatwa in a piece in The New Yorker titled My Unfunny Valentine, Rushdie had stated that he was now going to write only of love. Love feels more and more like the only subject. At the center of my life, of my new work, of my future plans, I now find nothing else. When I reread these words this past weekend, I thought of Hadi Matar in his jail cell. Acting in the spirit of Rushdie's words, I wanted to address Matar as a fellow human being and offer him an invitation to read. I grew up in India's poorest state, and if I hadn't found the path of reading, I could have ended up being killed, or, pity the thought, a killer. I wanted to say to Matar that, like the man he tried to kill, I too am a writer. As my life has been given over to reading and writing books, I hold on to the belief that if we read wildly and deeply, we will encounter people and places unlike ourselves. This sense of difference, its pleasures and challenges, will perhaps steer us away from intolerance. Many people in this country, including Malcolm X, discovered reading in prison and were transformed. I hope that Matar, too, will find a similar liberation in learning. One further point. We have seen the universal outpouring of grief and concern for Rushdie. People have been posting his lines on social media. They are discussing the influence of his work. I have read nothing but his words in essays, novels, and interviews since the attack. My son, only 12, has declared his interest in reading the Satanic Verses. I think he should wait. The reading we have done has been a great consolation. Hadi Matar's attack has failed, as any act of violence and in such circumstances inevitably would, because he has succeeded only in returning us to Rushdie's words. May literature live forever. Our next article by Elena Nicolou is titled, The Trailer for Oprah's Documentary About Sidney Poitier Has Arrived. Among his many accomplishments, Sidney Poitier became the first black man to win an Academy Award for Best Actor in 1963. In the wake of his death on January 6, 2022, at the age of 94, Poitier's legacy was celebrated by revisiting words of wisdom gleaned from his memoir, an Oprah's Book Club pick, and his filmography. Premiering on Apple TV Plus and in theaters on September 23, 2022, the forthcoming documentary, simply titled Sidney, will provide an even more comprehensive look into his life and impact on culture. Over a year in the making, Sidney was executive produced by Oprah, Poitier's longtime friend, and directed by Reginald Hudlin, who also directed The Black Godfather and Marshall. It also features candid interviews with Denzel Washington, Halle Berry, Robert Redford, Lenny Kravitz, Barbra Streisand, Spike Lee, and many more. Oprah and Poitier first met in 2000 on The Oprah Winfrey Show, though you could say their relationship began in 1964 when Oprah, then 10, watched Poitier accept the Academy Award for his performance in Lilies of the Field. In my spirit, I knew that because you had won the Oscar, I too could do something special, and I didn't even know what it was, Oprah told Poitier during their first meeting. I thought, if he can be that, I wonder what I can be. Poitier and Oprah had multiple public exchanges following that meeting. Poitier surprised her during the 20th anniversary celebration of the Oprah Winfrey Show, joined her for a two-part episode of Masterclass, and sat down with her after she selected his memoir, The Measure of a Man, for her book club in 2007. The documentary, in a way, continues the work Oprah has done to shine a light on Poitier's life story and the values and principles he picked up along the way. Though Poitier was born in Miami in 1927, he spent most of his childhood on a small island in the Bahamas. The child of impoverished tomato farmers, Poitier dropped out of school at the age of 13, following just a year and a half of in-class education. Speaking to Oprah in 2000 for the Oprah magazine, Poitier discussed how he maintained his sense of self as he adjusted to culture shock in the United States. When I arrived at the age of 15, almost everything I heard said to me, there are different values here. Here you are not the person you think you are. But I came with 15 years of preparation. I was strong enough to say to myself, the me that I've been for 15 years, I like that me. That's a free me. I can't adjust to being a restricted me, he said. Following an extraordinary progression, Poitier moved to New York, where he learned to read and worked odd jobs, all while pursuing a career as an actor. He became virtually the only black film star of the 1950s and 60s. With his roles in The Defiant Ones of 1958, A Raisin in the Sun, 1961, Guess Who's Coming to Dinner in 1967, and To Sir with Love in 1967, Poitier transformed how black characters were portrayed in Hollywood and had a major role in reshaping culture. He was hugely influential. This is an actor who changed the minds of many white people about black people, about seeing black people as complex human beings. He paved the way for so many generations of black actors to follow. There were very few models for him, but he was the model, film professor Jacqueline Stewart said on a PBS program commemorating Poitier. Upon Poitier's death, Oprah reflected on his life and the impact he made on hers. "For me, the greatest of the great trees has fallen," Oprah said. "My honor to have loved him as a mentor, friend, brother, confidant, wisdom teacher." Washington, who was the second Black actor to win the Academy Award for Best Actor, shared, "He was a gentleman and opened doors for all of us that had been closed for years." Hudlin, who is directing the forthcoming Apple TV Plus documentary, also provided his take on Poitier's impact. "Sidney Poitier defined manhood. He defined excellence, class, and elegance. He represented the best of Black experience, the immigrant experience, the artistic journey, and the American dream," he wrote on Twitter. Our next article by Dan Avery is titled, "Beaming with Pride: How TV Became the Unsung Hero for LGBTQ Plus Representation." The turn of the 21st century was a pivotal time for LGBTQ plus representation. Before streaming services and social media, television was the medium that mattered. Mainstream movies largely avoided gay themes, which could cost studios at the box office. And those that did tread in queer waters weren't widely seen, such as Tu Wong Fu, Julie Newmar, Jeffrey, and Thanks for Everything. In the music world, pop stars like Boy George, Elton John, and George Michael either danced around their sexuality or avoided pronouns or other telltale specifics in their lyrics. But television was universal. There were only a handful of channels watched by millions of people, mostly in real time. The impact of a single scene couldn't be underestimated. I remember vividly the first time I saw a gay person on TV. Not a gay character or an actor that everyone knew was gay in real life. I mean a real-life, out-and-proud gay man. It was Norman Corby on the first season of MTV's The Real World. By the time I was 14, I figured out I was gay. But the only mentions of homosexuality on TV were either played for laughs or were terrifying news reports about the AIDS epidemic. I assumed I was destined for a sad, lonely existence filled with rejection. Then, in 1992, MTV brought together seven strangers to live in a house. Every private moment of their lives would be taped for millions of viewers to witness. Watching Norm on The Real World blew away all those horrible stereotypes about queer people that had taken up space in my mind. He was young, happy, and self-confident. Norm was an openly gay man living his dream in New York City, going on dates and enjoying friendships with straight people. For the first time, I imagined a future for myself that was filled with friends, success, and maybe even love. It's amazing to realize what an impact a single TV show had on me and countless others. 2 years later, through watching The Real World San Francisco, Season 3, I first encountered someone with HIV/AIDS. Pedro Zamora, a 22-year-old Cuban-American from Miami, was open about his diagnosis from the start. The season showed him living life to the fullest, including marrying his boyfriend Sean in the first same-sex ceremony in television history. Having grown up during the worst days of the AIDS epidemic, I was terrified by Pedro's illness, but I was inspired by his courage and his zest for life, which changed how many Americans, especially younger ones, viewed people living with HIV. After Zamora died on November 11, 1994, President Bill Clinton said he had taught all of us that AIDS is a disease with a human face and one that affects every American. He also praised him for showing people living with AIDS how to fight for their rights and live with dignity. As The Real World was bringing us fully realized LGBTQ plus people, network television was just taking its first baby steps towards queer visibility. In 1991, NBC aired TV's first lesbian kiss on an episode of L.A. Law. It would be 6 years before Ellen DeGeneres came out, both on her self-titled sitcom and in real life. It's hard to overestimate what a cultural turning point that was. DeGeneres, a household name by that point, appeared on the April 14, 1997 cover of Time magazine with the headline reading, "Yep, I'm gay." Those of us leaning out the closet door finally had a real-life icon to point to. And according to a 2015 survey by Variety, DeGeneres' coming out did more to influence America's attitudes about gay rights than any other celebrity. Ellen brought us into America's living rooms in a way that we had never been before. The coming out episode was viewed by 42 million people and received both a Peabody Award and an Emmy. I remember standing in the middle of JR's in Washington, D.C., watching the puppy episode. The entire bar exploded in cheers as the character Ellen Morgan accidentally shouted she was gay over an airport PA system. It was like a wall had come down, an invisible barrier that was never addressed but always there. But the episode was unsurprisingly met with backlash, too. A group calling itself Media Research ran a full-page ad in Variety proclaiming that ABC was promoting homosexuality. Televangelist Jerry Falwell dubbed the comedian Ellen Degenerate and called for an advertising boycott of the show. JCPenney and Chrysler decided not to buy airtime during the coming out episode, and Wendy stopped advertising on the show altogether. ABC canceled Ellen after another season, and DeGeneres was persona non grata in Hollywood for some time. In 1998, the same year Ellen went off the air, another show arrived to carry the torch for queer representation on the small screen, Will and Grace. Ellen had been criticized for being too heavy-handed, but the NBC sitcom about a gay man and his best female friend worked to win people over with laughter. "It was just funny," Eric McCormick, who played Will Truman, told the CBC in 2021. "You could sit down with your grandmother and watch it, and suddenly your grandmother could feel differently and be introduced to the subject, in a way, in your living room." The show was one of the most popular on NBC's must-see TV lineup, earning 18 primetime Emmys throughout its 11 seasons. Amid the chuckles, it seemed to have changed hearts and minds. In 1996, 2 years before Will and Grace debuted, only 27% of Americans backed same-sex marriage. By 2006, when the original series ended, it had jumped to 42%. In 2012, when the Vice President Joe Biden announced his support for marriage equality, he credited Will and Grace for doing more to educate the American public than almost anything anybody has done so far. The late 90s and early aughts were a watershed moment for visibility, with characters and shows that had a profound impact on pop culture and on people's attitudes towards the LGBTQ+ community. As an Entertainment Weekly cover story proclaimed at the time, in 1995, the gay stream flows freely into the mainstream. Why did the dam burst then? Maybe it was having Clinton, an ally of sorts, in the White House. Or the AIDS crisis finally reaching the mainstream, forcing Americans to look at homosexuality honestly after ignoring it or joking about it for so long. Or maybe the 90s were just the era when television finally grew up. Whatever the reason, the impact of that decade is still felt on Pose, Love, Victor, Euphoria, and so many other series. I can only imagine the future influence of today's queer-focused shows, in which we're seeing more comfort showing LGBTQ+ characters of all ages, walks of life, ethnicities, and nationalities, and the types of conversations we'll be having 30 years from now. Hopefully, seeing the intersectionality and diversity of identities that are hallmarks of the queer community streamed and beamed to us, wherever we are, will be normal. We won't even give it a second thought. Here's a list of the most impactful LGBTQ+ characters in TV history. Be it network, cable, or streaming, television is the most powerful entertainment medium for affecting cultural change. Week after week, characters are brought onto our screens and erode long-standing prejudices and misconceptions. Nowhere is this truer than the LGBTQ+ representation in television, which has shifted from non-existent to nearly ubiquitous in a matter of decades. According to GLAAD, LGBTQ+ characters are at a record high in the 2021-2022 season, representing more than 1 in 9 of all regular characters on American television, an increase of more than 20% from last season. The portrayals are almost always hard-fought as creators and performers face opposition from networks, viewers, and conservatives. But representation is vital. Queer characters hold the power to change attitudes while providing a lifeline to people struggling with their identity or orientation. In celebration of Pride, we're revisiting and honoring 15 of the most iconic LGBTQ+ characters in television history. Beverly LaSalle of All in the Family, which ran from 1971 to 1979. Beginning in 1975, comedian Lori Shannon appeared as Edith Bunker's female impersonator friend, Beverly LaSalle, in 3 episodes of CBS's All in the Family. That in itself was a watershed development, a drag queen presented in a positive, affirming light on one of America's top-rated TV shows. But it was LaSalle's final appearance in 1977's Edith's Crisis of Faith episode that was the most poignant. In the season 8 episode, Beverly visits the Bunkers at Christmas time as she prepares for her Carnegie Hall debut. The family welcomes her warmly, but is Beverly out of drag? And Archie's son-in-law, Mike, walked to the subway, they are brutally attacked by gay bashers who beat Beverly to death. The murder of her friend causes Edith to struggle over the existence of God and question how she can move forward. Mike eventually encourages Edith to be strong for her family, but it's clear her crisis of faith isn't resolved when the closing credits run. Jodi Dallas, Soap, which ran from 1977 to 1981. A young Billy Crystal played Jodi Dallas, one of the first recurring gay characters on American TV, in the sitcom send-up of daytime dramas. That makes Dallas noteworthy, even though gay groups at the time complained that Dallas was a jumble of negative stereotypes about homosexuality. At various points, Jodi attempts suicide, contemplates gender reassignment surgery, and even fathers a child after a one-night stand with a woman. In fact, despite insisting he is gay, Jodi has more relationships with women than men. He manages to have a single date with a man in one episode. In the 1981 finale, Jodi undergoes hypnotherapy and winds up believing he is actually an elderly Jewish man named Julius Kassendorf. Stephen Carrington, Dynasty, which ran from 1981 to 1989. Dynasty helped launch the glitzy nighttime soap era of the 1980s, and Steve Carrington was one of primetime's first major gay characters as the son of tycoon Blake Carrington. First played by actor Al Corley and later Jack Coleman, Stephen was blonde and hunky with a stronger moral center than his conniving family. But like soap's Jodi Dallas, he was largely defined by his struggles with his sexuality. Like Dallas, he had relationships with both men and women, most famously Sammy Joe, played by Heather Locklear. Corley once told Interview he was eager to play a gay character, but that Stephen has no humor and suffers from ever-shifting sexual preferences. In later years, Dynasty's producers admitted interference from ABC and protests by conservative religious groups made it nearly impossible to evolve the character. When the show was revived for the 1991 miniseries, Dynasty the Reunion, Stephen was portrayed as openly gay and in a stable relationship. The CW rebooted Dynasty in 2017, and James McKay took on the mantle of Stephen Carrington, but was abruptly written out in season 2. Ricky Vasquez, My So-Called Life, which ran from 1994 to 1995. Though it lasted just one season, My So-Called Life had been hailed for its unvarnished depiction of adolescence. Queer characters had already started to pop up on adult dramas, including 30-something, L.A. Law, and Roseanne. But Ricky, played by Wilson Cruz, was a gay teen who was uncomfortable at school where he hid in the girls' bathroom. At home, his uncle abused him. Instead of a throwaway background character for protagonist Angela Chase, a young Claire Danes, to interact with, Ricky was given his own storylines as well as the chance to figure his identity out on his own terms. My So-Called Life also marked the first time an openly gay actor, Wilson Cruz, played a gay character, giving Ricky a richer sense of authenticity. LGBTQ students have been in existence forever, and we will be here forever, Cruz told Today in 2021. Ricky Vasquez was just the first person to say, I deserve to be loved too. Ellen Morgan, Ellen, which ran from 1994 to 1998. Every gay person of a certain age remembers where they were when Ellen's The Puppy episode aired in 1997. The two-parter that saw Ellen DeGeneres' character come out as a lesbian, coinciding with the comedian's own real-life coming out. Ellen Morgan was the first gay lead character in a primetime series, and audiences followed her journey of self-acceptance, disclosure, and romantic relationships. It's a feat that's never really been repeated since. And though the storyline drew critical acclaim and awards, it earned criticism from conservatives as well. An ABC affiliate in Alabama refused to air the puppy episode, and several advertisers pulled out of the show. After floundering through another season, Ellen was canceled. It didn't help that it began airing a parental warning after Ellen came out. "It was very offensive," DeGeneres told Entertainment Weekly. "You don't think that's going to affect ratings?" DeGeneres' brave move cost her career-wise, and it wasn't until her 2003 talk show that she emerged back on top. Willow Rosenberg, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, which ran from 1997 to 2001. While Sarah Michelle Gellar was the undisputed star of this cult favorite, Allison Hannigan's Willow was a true scene stealer, using her brains, wits, and magic to get the Scooby Gang out of numerous jams. Initially straight-identified, Willow became drawn to fellow spellcaster Tara, played by Amber Benson, and many 90s teens identified with her struggles with her sexuality. Eventually, the two became one of the first depictions of a stable lesbian relationship on primetime television. Unfortunately, Tara was abruptly killed in season 6, which outraged many fans. Ultimately, the frequent deaths of LGBTQ characters on TV led to organized criticism of what was dubbed the "bury your gays" trope. Will Truman, Will and Grace, which ran from 1998 to 2006. Jack McFarlane, played by Sean Hayes, got the big laughs on this top-rated NBC sitcom. But Will Truman, played by Eric McCormick, was the grounded counterpoint to Jack's flamboyance. Will's deep, though platonic love for Grace, played by Deborah Messing, resonated with many viewers, and the show's unapologetic depiction of a smart, successful gay man searching for love educated countless more. In the 90s, conservatives railed against feminism, multiculturalism, and gay acceptance. At the 1992 Republican National Convention, commentator-turned-presidential candidate Pat Buchanan warned of a cultural war for the soul of America. In the same era, Will and Grace tried to make peace through the power of humor. "I was very acutely aware that the larger part of the audience of Will and Grace was straight," co-creator Max Machutnik told Logo TV in 2008. Co-creator David Cohen and I said to each other, "We'll have won if by the time the show is over, the audience wants Will to be in love, wants him to be in a relationship." Brian Kinney, Queer as Folk, which ran from 2000 to 2005. If Will Truman showed America that gay men could be more than just their sexuality, Gale Harold's Brian Kinney was a voracious sexual being with little use for social conventions. In a pre-internet world, Queer as Folk was the first series to show gay men having sex, not just a peck on the cheek or the camera fading to black. The series opens with 29-year-old Kinney driving Justin, his 17-year-old hookup from the night before, to school. Today, that would probably be more problematic, but coming in a time when HIV was suddenly no longer a death sentence, Kinney embodied a refreshingly raw eroticism. Shane McCutcheon, The L Word, which ran from 2004 to 2009. In The L Word, hairstylist Shane McCutcheon presented an unapologetically queer character who defied expectations and categorizations. Played by Kate Monig, Shane was neither fully butch nor femme, but an androgynous heartthrob with leather pants, a Mick Jagger swagger, and a sardonic streak a mile wide. Shane was the only non-femme main character, and seeing her have internal struggles that weren't just about being gay was so important to queer kids, Jacqueline Taboni, who co-starred with Monig on the 2019 reboot The L Word Generation Q, told Vogue. There was a split between, "Oh my God, I want to be her," and, "Oh my God, I'm in love with her." Mitchell Pritchett, Modern Family, which ran from 2009 to 2020. At first glance, Modern Family felt like a fairly conventional network comedy. But the show was groundbreaking for LGBTQ representation because audiences were able to witness Mitch's, played by Jesse Tyler Ferguson, evolution as a man, a partner, and a father over 11 impressive seasons. While Mitch's relationship with his husband Cam, played by Eric Stonestreet, helped eradicate stigma, the tension with his father Jay, played by Ed O'Neill, mirrored the dynamic many LGBTQ people felt with their families of origin. Mitch once said he had to come out to his dad more than once because Jay kept ignoring him. But it was always depicted with humor and heart, and it helped normalize gay relationships for many straight viewers. Kurt Hummel, Glee, which ran from 2009 to 2015. Chris Colfter was only 18 when Glee debuted on Fox. But as gay contrateur Kurt Hummel, he brought a talent and wit far beyond his years and earned several Emmy nominations for it. Kurt was a study in contrasts, feminine and frivolous, often bitchy, but still loving to his friends and blue-collar dad. When Glee debuted in 2009, a gay teen was still a rarity on television, especially when allowed to get the guy, as Kurt was with longtime flame Blaine, played by Darren Criss. When I found out that I got cast as a gay character on Glee, I had thought my career was going to be over, Colfer admitted to Entertainment Weekly in 2015 when the show was ending. At the time, it was such a taboo for an actor of any age to play a gay character, he said. And now you look and there are multiple gay characters on every single show. Will Horton, Days of Our Lives, 2010 to present. Will wasn't the first gay man on daytime TV, but he's a legacy character on one of America's longest-running soap operas. Audiences have been invested in him literally from birth and through numerous over-the-top storylines. Will's coming out in 2012, though, was more grounded in reality as he struggled with denial, alcohol abuse, and other issues. Eventually, he and boyfriend Sonny, played by Freddie Smith, became the show's first gay power couple. In 2014, they tied the knot in daytime's first same-sex male wedding, officiated no less by Days of Our Lives' grand dame, Deidre Hall. Several actors have played Will over the years, but the current and best known is Chandler Massey, who earned 3 back-to-back daytime Emmys for the role. Will's grisly murder in 2015 outraged many devoted fans, and once again it raised criticism of how often gay TV characters are killed off. The character was later resurrected, and Will has regularly appeared on Days of Our Lives and its spin-off Peacock series, Beyond Salem. Sophia Bursette, Orange is the New Black, which aired from 2013 to 2019. By the second decade of the 21st century, gay and lesbian representation was fairly entrenched on television, but trans people were still largely invisible. Laverne Cox's role on Netflix's Orange is the New Black changed that. Sophia was the first recurring trans character on an ongoing series. Sophia was hardened by her surroundings at the fictional Litchfield prison, but she also had a fragility that captured the viewer's attention. In 2014, Cox became the first transgender actor to be nominated for a primetime Emmy. Though Sophia spent most of season 4 in solitary confinement, she won early release in the 7th and final season and was finally able to open her beauty salon. I thought, what can it mean for audiences to see this and for a black trans woman who's formerly incarcerated to get out of prison and win? Cox told TV Insider in 2020. We need to see that. I think sometimes if we can see it on screen, then we can begin to imagine it. Ruby and Sapphire / Garnet, Steven Universe, which ran from 2013 to 2019. When Steven Universe debuted on Cartoon Network, it broke new ground in LGBTQ plus representation in children's television, especially in cartoons. The show's creator, Rebecca Sugar, peppered queer-coded and non-binary characters throughout the series, but it was Garnet who won fans' hearts. The self-confident warrior is one of 3 living gems who guide Steve, but the season 1 finale revealed that Garnet is really the fusion of Ruby, played by Charlene Yee, and Sapphire, played by Erica Luttrell, 2 female-presenting gems who merged out of their love for each other. As the show progressed, Ruby and Sapphire's bond is strengthened, and they ultimately decide to marry in the channel's first gay wedding in 2018. Cartoon Network's chief content officer, Rob Sorcher, told the LA Times that the legacy of Steven Universe, which ended in 2019, is that it included such a wide spectrum of themes that were not ever really addressed in a realistic way on children's television. Blanca Evangelista, Pose, which aired from 2018 to 2021. Chosen families are a large part of the LGBTQ experience, and Pose's Blanca gave viewers a strong maternal presence in this Ryan Murphy-produced drama that explored New York City's ballroom culture and queer life in 1980s and 90s. Mother to the house of Evangelista, Blanca, played by Michaela J. Rodriguez, was a trans woman character who was the protagonist of her own story, rather than a supporting character, or worse, a plot device. In 2021, Rodriguez was nominated for an Emmy for Outstanding Lead Actress in a Drama and won a Golden Globe for Best Actress, a first for a transgender performer. In the series finale, Blanca sees her children reach their full potential and herself finally finding true love. She's getting all of the love and accolades she deserves from her community, Rodriguez told Salon. I'm so happy that it ended the way it did and that we tied the knots and crossed the T's, dotted those I's the right way. Our next article by Nico Maragos is titled, The Black Beauty Archives Are Preserving an Important Piece of Black History. In the spring of 2020, New York-based makeup artist and archivist Camille Lawrence found herself out of work, twice. Within weeks of the first stay-at-home order in March, the New York native was furloughed from her position as an archivist at the Brooklyn Academy of Music and saw her list of upcoming makeup gigs shrink to nothing. Soon, the 29-year-old says that she, like many of her beauty industry colleagues, fell into a depression. We were just sitting at home quarantined, frightened of COVID, looking at the numbers rising every day and our jobs being canceled, Lawrence tells Oprah Daily. I was wondering to myself, is my career ever going to pick up again? To rekindle the excitement of being on set and creating new looks for clients, Lawrence dove into her sprawling collection of beauty reference materials that she, like many other makeup artists, had accumulated over the years. Scraps of fabrics, Polaroids, behind-the-scenes photos, makeup artistry books, whatever items she'd encountered and liked over the years, Lawrence kept. These private collections are important components of the working lives of makeup artists and hairstylists who develop new styles based on the makeup and hair documented in these resources. Lawrence's personal collection, however, has a specific slant. Over the years, I had also started collecting beauty portraits of unknown black folks, Lawrence says. I'd save them all in an album because I felt like they'd be safer in my home close to my ancestral altar as opposed to floating around in the world. For Lawrence, the documented history of the American beauty industry has predominantly been a story of white faces wearing makeup and hair designed by white beauty professionals. How the aesthetic of black beauty has evolved, as well as the ways black beauty professionals have contributed to the hairstyling and makeup industries, was a story that no one was telling. Lawrence long hoped to correct this historical blind spot, but the details of how exactly she would do it weren't clear, until one morning in April 2020, after weeks of pandemic-induced playtime in her personal beauty archives. I woke up, shook my husband, and I'm like, yo, why don't we have a library, Lawrence says. Why can't I go somewhere right now and see black beauty from the 60s? Lawrence says she searched for an existing archive of black beauty references images without success. So she started working on a project that would later become the Black Beauty Archives. Launched on Juneteenth, 2020, the BBA is a black-owned and operated initiative created to preserve, document, and celebrate the history of black beauty through cosmetics and beauty culture. The Black Beauty Archives is a digital and physical library of vintage beauty products, media, recorded oral histories, transcribed beauty rituals, and images of, by, or for black women from the 1950s to the present. This is the beginning of a snowball effect that will transform how black beauty is not only documented and preserved, but discussed with nuance from a scholarly perspective, says makeup artist and makeup historian Michaela Werribee, who serves as beauty historian of the Black Beauty Archives. The Museum of Black Beauty, launched digitally in 2019, collects similar artifacts, as does the National Museum of African American History and Culture. Unlike those resources, the Black Beauty Archives is not connected to or affiliated with an existing institution. With time, love, and donations, Lawrence hopes to soon have a full physical viewing space where anyone can access the materials she and her colleagues have curated on site. For now, the items are stored and carefully preserved according to archival standards and can be viewed in person through research requests. Many of Lawrence's collected magazine covers, beauty advertisements, and other media are also available for viewing on the Black Beauty Archives website. According to Lawrence, the Black Beauty Archives also makes it easier to design new makeup looks based on historical looks worn by Black women. Such archival research is far more important to modern makeup artistry than you might think. For example, the game-changing makeup of HBO's Euphoria, designed by Daniela Davey, cites archival images of Nina Simone. For Lawrence, building the Black Beauty Archives is about much more than just solving a technical problem for makeup artists and hairstylists. It is about creating a resource for discovering and sharing Black history through the beauty rituals that facilitate the transmission of wisdom from one generation to the next. These intimate experiences are not always in traditional institutions like museums or academic spaces, says Lawrence. They're happening in the kitchen. They're happening at the kitchen sink. They're happening in the bathroom. They're happening on the front step, on a stoop in the backyard, and in braiding salons across New York City and across the globe. As an undergraduate studying art history, Lawrence worked as a freelance makeup artist to help pay her way through college. Occasionally, Lawrence tried to merge her two worlds and incorporate a critical study of beauty and Blackness into her academic work, but says she perceived resistance. Anytime I tried to weave in the narrative of Black beauty and Black history, people didn't take it as something that should be valued or was real, Lawrence recalls. You have to argue tooth and nail that, for example, a Black beauty salon is an evocative site for identity formation, and that wearing your hair natural is an act of revolution. In that sense, beauty tools, practices, and other artifacts bear witness to a host of unwritten histories. A vintage hot comb, for example, used across several generations of Black women, is dense with memories passed from grandmother to granddaughter. Seeing such tools taken seriously in an archival context might trigger people to remember family history, shared wisdom, and more stories. That's something that Reagan Summer McCoy realized when she visited her grandmother's South Carolina home last December. A friend of Lawrence's and a fellow archivist, McCoy is the founder of the Mixtape Museum, a hip-hop archive. She was perusing her grandmother's belongings for potential artifacts relevant to her work, but instead found her grandmother's hot comb, a tool used to relax Black hair. As I was going through more stuff, it just made me connect with the hot comb differently, McCoy says. I wasn't thinking about the ritual practice behind hot combing in Black culture, but I got my hair hot combed, my daughter got her hair hot combed, everyone in my family has gotten their hair hot combed. The realization that the items in our family homes are more than just objects prompted McCoy to call Lawrence, fill out the appropriate donation form on the Black Beauty Archives website, carefully clean the hot comb, photograph it, and donate it to the project. The ritual practice that we have in families, the things that are passed down, that's super important, says McCoy. I feel like the Black Beauty Archives confirm legacies in ways that you don't think about. While going through her own collection, Lawrence made a powerful discovery. She found items from her husband's grandmother, Sandra Parker, who ran a beauty salon out of a storefront and later the Queens, New York apartment where Lawrence built her first makeup studio. In 2022, Lawrence plans to launch a digital collection honoring Parker's decades of work, featuring photographs from Parker's collection and oral histories. Lawrence hopes to collect more tools, products, and images from Black people around the country and ultimately house them in a dedicated building that will be open for use by researchers, beauty professionals, and however Black folks see fit, she says. But Lawrence also recognizes the deep emotional meaning of such artifacts to the families that maintain them and hopes to offer educational services on how to best preserve them in your own home. If your grandma has a whole bunch of magazines that you're just sitting on, please mail them to our P.O. box, Lawrence says. If you have beautiful portraits of your Nana or your aunties with their beauty shots and they're just sitting rotting, we can teach you how to preserve your family history, or you can donate them for long-term preservation. They'll be in good hands. Follow the Black Beauty Archives on Instagram and TikTok. If you have beauty images, products, or other materials to donate, please send them here. P.O. Box 650278, Fresh Meadows, New York, 11365-9994. Our next article by Cassie Hurwitz is titled Ways to Live Life to the Fullest. We have all heard that we should live life to its fullest, but how do you do that? Especially when some days it feels like your to-do list is a mile long and you can't get off the hamster wheel long enough to look around and enjoy. Even if you start fun projects, it can feel impossible to finish them and you end up with abandoned home improvement projects, countless jigsaw puzzles that are half done, or new hobbies that have been started and ignored. If you think about it, these things can add enjoyment, but they don't speak to your soul, and living a full life is all about connecting to your deep down self. So we spoke to wellness experts, therapists, and doctors, each of whom gave advice on what it means to live a fuller life, and tips on how to actually make it stick. Listen to your inner being. Learn to trust and listen to that spirit inside of you that wants nothing more than to direct you closer to the person you are meant to be and the life you are meant to live, says Camila Martin, a nonprofit executive turned consultant focusing on empowering Black women through community. Accepting, even celebrating, the discoveries that show up is her advice for anyone looking to live a fuller life. Understand the power of authenticity. Being your true, authentic self allows you to follow your passion, says Jason Phillips, a licensed therapist. Authenticity is about being true to one's own personality, spirit, or character. When we don't accept who we are, he continues, we live life, but it's not to the fullest because we're operating from someone else's perspective and doing what someone else wants us to do. Living life to its fullest means not holding back, having the courage to live the life that is truest and most authentic to each of us, and not the life that is expected of us by others or society, says Tammy Chang, MD, a board-certified physician and author of the book Boundaries for Women Physicians, which focuses on self-care and avoiding burnout. Get rid of the supposed to's. My life for many years was dictated by the supposed to's, Martin says. This is the career I'm supposed to have, the marriage and family I'm supposed to have. This is the way I'm supposed to carry myself. This is how I'm supposed to speak, look, behave. But when you clear all that away, you're left with the person you truly want to be. The joy and fulfillment comes in the journey of releasing and in the confidence of trusting yourself, she says. Visualize your future self. At the Coactive Training Institute, Chang learned a technique called future self visualization. It takes us to meet ourselves 20 years into the future and to gain the wisdom of our older, experienced, and wiser inner self, she explains. Some of the greatest wisdom we have is right there inside of ourselves. Just like getting to know yourself and leaning into your authenticity, letting your inner voice guide you is a way to achieve a fuller life. The experience empowers us to live in a way that is more full, more in alignment with who we really are, and to give ourselves permission to let go of the shoulds in our lives. Define your core values. So many of us struggle to find our meaning, purpose, and anchor in life, Chang says. Her solution? Uncovering the 3 to 5 core values that make you tick. This might seem easier said than done, but Chang has a few questions that can help you explore. What would you take a stand for? What makes you mad, like mad, and why is that? What are the peak moments of your life until today? What are the common threads between these moments or experiences? For Phillips, identifying those values is crucial too, whether it's gaining financial security or finding a sense of spirituality. Once you define your values, you can look at your behavior and notice if your value is in alignment with your behavior, he says. If there's a disconnect, you now have a starting point of where to remedy as opposed to feeling lost and stuck. Let beliefs lead to passions. Once you've defined your core principles, you can follow that path to finding things you're passionate about, in turn filling your days with what you enjoy. When we do the things we're passionate about, we can wake up looking forward to the day, Phillips says. For Martin, that was learning photography recently. That gift has blossomed into some incredibly beautiful opportunities, she says. Leaning into this hobby and passion has brought so much unexpected joy and fulfillment. Help someone. One possible thing to feel passionate about, we are wired to experience joy in the serving and helping of others, Chang says. It's the most natural form of experiencing an emotional high. Giving back can come in a variety of forms, from volunteering your time to donating money. Whatever it is, the cause you choose to support should align with those values you defined earlier. And lastly, hold no regrets. When you come to the end of your life, what is it that will have meant the most to you, to your loved ones, to those you've never even met, says Chang. Know that you have an impact on countless others throughout your lifetime, and that the ripple effects of you, your being, and your impact is there. You matter. Make your life on this earth count. Don't just go through the motions. What will your life have been all about when you come to the end of yours? When you come to the end of your life, what is it that will have meant the most to you, to your loved ones, to those you've never even met, says Chang. Know that you have an impact on countless others throughout your lifetime, and that the ripple effects of you, your being, and your impact is there. You matter. Make your life on this earth count. Don't just go through the motions. What will your life have been all about when you come to the end of yours? We have run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it and be sure to listen next time. I'm Brandi Spragata, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Oprah Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.